In Gaza, there are no good options. Nevertheless, the only way to move towards our targets can be done if we really mean to take over Gaza. Unless Hamas believes that we are ready to do that, it is not going to show any flexibility, as we've seen until now. They have to be convinced that we are about to take over Gaza by force and remove them from power by force.
Welcome to the Misugava Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to truly understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Misugava Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, your co-host and executive director of the Misugava Institute for National Security. The Misugava Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international alliances. Every week on Mideast Horizons, we go beyond the headlines and the noise to bring you fresh insights into the most critical issues of the national security agenda in the Middle East, as well as updates on the trends and opportunities taking shape in this incredible region.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcast to keep up to date and ahead of the curve on everything connected to the Middle East. You can reach out to us with comments, questions, and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And we read all of your comments and we respond. We appreciate those who have sent us very good suggestions. This week, we are going to speak to Brigadier General Yossi Kubrewasser, Cooper, who served as head of IDF research and analysis in IDF intelligence. He also served as the chief intelligence officer of Central Command, responsible for the Palestinian arena. Today, he is the director of the Jerusalem Institute for Security and Strategy. He was also one of the founding fellows of the Misugava Institute. But before we speak to General Kubrewasser, let's talk about some of the developments taking place just this morning.
So we are talking, I think, hours before the cabinet is expected to vote on what exactly is going to happen in Gaza. The expectation is they're going to intensify the fighting in Gaza. What exactly that means is not clear, but it seems that the IDF is going to move into the 25% of Gaza that it doesn't control. The hostages are held in some of those areas. So that's something that, you know, is very controversial here in Israel, because in the past, when the IDF has gotten close to rescuing, I mean, the IDF has successfully rescued some hostages, but there was also a case where the IDF was very close to where some hostages were located and Hamas executed three hostages rather than have the IDF rescue them. So there is a worry in Israel that this is going to be a danger to the life of the hostages. On the other hand, the war has been dragging on for 22 months now with no end. And so, you know, the government wants to try something different, try to push Hamas even more to try to reach that total victory and eliminate Hamas control of Gaza. So that's where we are with that. Asher, do you think that this is the right move?
Well, it remains to be seen what the IDF will actually do. We saw with the Gideon's Chariots operation that despite sort of the bombastic statements, the underlying logic of that operation remained not defeating Hamas, but pressuring Hamas to release the hostages. And it remains to be seen what will happen this time. But in a sense, I think also this idea that Israel will have to take over the entire Gaza Strip was in some ways inevitable due to the international discourse regarding Israel's responsibilities for the humanitarian situation in Gaza. So what I think happened was that Israel assumed that the expectation of it would be that it had to ensure that sufficient food for the Gazan population was entering Gaza. But it turned out that the international demand, which I think is unique to Israel, is that Israel's responsibility is to ensure that every Gazan receives sufficient food, despite the fact that we know that Hamas and criminal gangs and powerful families and clans are stealing the food. So given that much of the food is being diverted, Israel still has to make sure that food reaches every Gazan. And we know we know that they're stealing the aid and putting
it on
the market.
Let's just say it's pretty absurd.
Right. And look,
I mean, you said it's unique to Israel. It's not just unique. It's like unprecedented. It doesn't make any sense. Like, I mean, unless they want Israel to move in and be the actual governors of Gaza, which I think nobody wants. Israel doesn't really want that. And the world will consider that an illegal occupation. How is Israel supposed to make sure every single person is getting the food they need beyond just making sure the food gets into Gaza?
Right. I mean, the food is coming in as aid. There are markets or around Gaza, right? So we know that people are stealing the aid and selling it in markets. The argument, though, is that the prices at the markets are too high for the average Gazan to afford. So Israel needs to bring in enough food so that the prices in the market will be affordable to the average Gazan, or that they'll have alternatives and they won't have to go to the market. And like you said, I think that's unprecedented. And in a sense, I think part of the what's well, been called the failure, the mistake of Israel was in failing to understand that it was being this new expectation. But if that is indeed the expectation, that is a very, very short step to say, well, then in that case, Israel has to take responsibility for everything that's going on in the Gaza Strip.
So I want to, just before we move to the domestic Israeli part, I want to like clear up what I think is like a misconception. A lot of the news articles use the word occupy, that Israel's going to occupy Gaza now. And it's not incorrect, like that is a correct military term, but I think that the connotation for a lot of people is that Gaza is going to look like Judea and Samaria, which like that the IDF is going to be there for a long time. Maybe some Israelis will move in there. I don't think that that's the intention or the plan. The idea is just that the IDF will move into further areas of Gaza and do what it's been doing for the last few months, right? Because for the first year and almost year and a half of the war, Israel would do raids. They'd go into a place and then they'd get out. But once we saw that the terrorists just came back to any place that the IDF left, which honestly, I don't know why they didn't realize that in the first place. I'm not a military strategist and I probably could have told them that.
But just to point out, I mean, people, these fighters are in, for the most part, they're not even in the tunnels. What they are is they're in the humanitarian area. They're in the Mawasi. They're just hanging out and they're waiting for the IDF to leave. And then they'll just leave this humanitarian area. The IDF is not operating in these humanitarian areas. And they just resume their terror activities in every area that Israel pulls out from.
Right. So since March, the idea has been that Israel is going to come take a place and the soldiers will stay in that place so that Hamas doesn't come back. But it's not like Israelis are moving in to live there and to stay forever. It's a military only occupation. And I think that the use of the word occupation as opposed to, I don't know, to conquer, to control, to take over. I tried to use a lot of others when I wrote about it because I realized that when I saw occupation, they would jump to a different conclusion. So I just wanted to clarify that point.
And it's a good point. And also, I think the word annexation in that context also is less accurate because at this point, Israel is not talking about annexing Gaza or applying its sovereignty over Gaza.
Correct. There was a report that Israel was considering sort of gradually annexing more and more of Gaza in order to put pressure on Hamas. Because, you know, by Israeli law, you need a vote of at least 80 members of Knesset to give up on any land you'd annex. So like if Israel legally annexes parts of Gaza, it would be very hard for them to give it back, so to speak, to Palestinians. But I don't think that's not the plan that's on the agenda right now for the cabinet. Like it might have been something that somebody presented to someone and then it leaked to the press, but that's not the actual plan at the moment. It could happen.
The other thing that I find very hard to understand is Hamas in Gaza is a terror group, but what really makes Hamas into this regional threat is the fact that it has its leadership sitting in Qatar, sitting in Turkey, and actively running its financial network, its business empire, out of these countries. Now, at least with those sitting in Qatar until now, the idea was that, well, we need to basically protect them or give them a free pass because we're conducting negotiations with them or because of sensitivities around the Qataris. But if indeed the intent is to defeat Hamas, and if indeed Israel has come to the conclusion that Hamas is unwilling to agree to a hostage deal, then it seems unreasonable that those leaders in Doha, in Turkey, in Istanbul, in Ankara should continue to be given a free pass. And at the very least, Israel, but certainly the United States, should demand that the leaders of Turkey and Qatar, this they could do right away, shut down these business networks, shut down these bank accounts, shut down these financial networks, arrest these leaders in order to prevent Hamas from continuing its terror attacks and from rebuilding itself.
Yeah, it seems very clear that the Trump administration has other interests in those countries and that it's not going. I mean, you never know in the future. President Trump is very unpredictable, but thus far, it seems that they prefer other interests in those countries to pressuring them to put pressure on Hamas, which is unfortunate because it feels like it's the only route that really hasn't been tried. I think that the Qataris have shown signs of, at the very least, being very upset that their reputation is being dragged through the mud because of their support for Hamas. I think that there's been some, at least on that front, there's been some successes of the public media campaigns. But of course, they have billions upon billions of dollars in so many different American and European institutions that they still remain highly influential. And it's unfortunate that neither the Biden administration nor the Trump administration would really bring down the hammer on them, because they absolutely deserve it. I mean, they are the funders, you know, they of the Muslim Brotherhood, of Al Jazeera, beyond what they do for Hamas.
I agree. Now, the Trump administration, though, has been very solidly behind Israel in terms of providing it with the military systems and means that it needs to defend itself. But we saw a vote on the Senate this week on a resolution proposed by Senator Bernie Sanders, which got a surprising degree of support, particularly from the Democratic Party. Lav, what are your thoughts on this vote?
Yeah, I mean, there were two different resolutions, and one got votes of 27 Democrats, which is the majority of Democrats, to ban selling guns to Israel. And then the other one is 24, which is not the majority, but it's about half, on selling bombs to Israel, right? So you have a situation where basically the Democratic mainstream doesn't want America to sell weapons to Israel anymore in what is basically a war against, well, we didn't think it was an existential threat, but it kind of became one, right? Like, if there is no war that is more just, we're talking about just war theory, than Israel's war in Gaza. Like, Hamas literally invaded Israel, killed over 1,000 people, kidnapped 250 people. And yet these Democrats, they don't have like the, you know, people I feel like in the West who maybe didn't experience war. Some of these people have, you know, you have Alyssa Slotkin, for example, who comes from the defense establishment. She voted against selling weapons to Israel. But you have a lot of people who live these sort of coddled lives where they haven't really had to experience war and terrorism the way we have in Israel. And they think that, like, you can just snap and, like, the war will go the way you want it and end the way you want it. And that's obviously not the case. Obviously, bad things happen in war. And obviously, you're going to see terrible pictures in literally any war. They don't have that patience. They're not using that judgment. And I think that they have pressure from the far left within the Democratic Party. And so these senators have turned on Israel. And I think more broadly, what it means for Israel is, first of all, that sort of fear that Israel has turned into a partisan issue is very much coming true. And I'm sorry, I know people want to paint this picture that it's true in the Republican Party as well. But if you read, there were all these articles in the last week, like MAGA turns against Israel. And we've talked about it here, you know, that there are influencers, right-wing influencers who are anti-Israel. But there's also the latest polling shows that 71% of Republicans support Israel. And I believe it was 6% of Democrats support Israel's war in Gaza at this point. So first of all, I think Israel really has become a partisan issue, because like how many Democrats are going to be against 94% of their voters, right? It's a real problem. It'll be a real danger for Israel if the next administration is Democratic. Normally, under normal circumstances, we say Israel needs to work harder at it. Israel needs to reach out to Democrats. And it's still true. But also, we're at war. And we can't like roll over and give up because the Democrats are voting against us. So it becomes an impossible situation.
I agree. The situation is very difficult. And it's true that Israel is being almost, I would say, criminally irresponsible in terms of working on the strategic communications aspect, the public relations aspect of the war. There are at least four really senior important positions in the Prime Minister's office in charge of coordinating Israel's messaging, Israel's, you know, presenting its side of the story, that are currently unfilled, that could be filled tomorrow, and it's somewhat difficult to understand why that is. But I think you're right. I think these are part of deeper trends where the divide between Israel and the West, between those who are facing the threat from Hamas terror and those who are sitting thousands of miles away. And at some point, Israel is also going to have to make that really difficult choice. Does it, at the current moment, focus on its defending its security and its vital interests? Or does it focus primarily on improving opinion about it in the West?
So one more thing I just wanted to bring up is that this week, according to the Hebrew date, is the 20th anniversary of the disengagement from Gaza, when Israel, under Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, fully pulled out of Gaza, demolished the 21 Israeli towns who lived there, cleared out 8,000 Israelis who were living in those towns, and pulled the entire Israeli military out of Gaza, including the Philadelphia corridor, which is along the border with Egypt. And the discourse in Israel is really interesting about it. I find that people are debating whether this caused sort of October 7th and the current war we're in or not. Obviously, you know, it was an 18 years between the disengagement and the October 7th attacks. So a lot of things happened in the interim. But one of the things we're going to talk to our next guest about is sort of what his experience was at that time as a high-ranking IDF officer, and also what kind of lessons Israel has learned from that time. I moved to Israel a few weeks before the disengagement, sort of observed all of this. I think it was a hugely impactful time on this country and where things went for our national security and also for our political culture. So I find that really interesting. Asher, you want to tell us a little bit more about our guest?
This week, we're going to speak to Brigadier General Yossi Cooperwasser, Cooper. Cooper had a long and distinguished military career. He served as Israel's intelligence attaché in Washington. He served as the chief military intelligence officer in IDF Central Command, responsible for Judea and Samaria. And then he served as head of research and analysis in IDF military intelligence from 2001 to 2006. So during the time both of the Second Intifada and of the disengagement. He then served as Director General of Israel's Strategic Affairs Ministry and later became one of the founding fellows at the Miskav Institute for National Security. Today, he is the director of the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security. And there are, as somebody who experienced the Intifada and the disengagement firsthand in his role, and as somebody who's continued to study both the Palestinian arena and the international arena very closely for years after, he is one of the experts both on the topic of the Palestinian arena, both in Gaza and the Palestinian Authority, and on the topic of combating the demonization BDS campaign against the State of Israel. So we're looking forward to a fascinating conversation with Brigadier General Yossi Cooperwasser. Stay tuned. Yossi Cooperwasser, Cooper, it's great to have you on the Miskav Mideast Horizons podcast. And I thought we'd start with a question that I received this morning from one of our listeners of the podcast. And he asks, why does Netanyahu think it's a good idea to annex all of Gaza? How does it really differ from the situation of the most recent part of the war? What can it further accomplish? Won't it end up leading Israel to take more of the blame for the humanitarian crisis? We heard the reports last night that Israel is intending to capture, conquer all of the Gaza Strip. Do you agree that's a good idea? And if so, why?
First of all, thank you for having me. It's good to be home, back home. Secondly, it's a very difficult question. We start this right away with difficult questions, but okay, we'll take it. In Gaza, there are no good options. That's the problem in Gaza. You can, whatever option you look at, you can only very easily point at the reasons why you shouldn't take it. It's any option. The option of continuing to do what we have done in the last 22 months is not a good option because it doesn't make enough pressure on Hamas in order to release the hostages and to accept the idea that they should give up their arms. So we end up with nothing. The option of succumbing to Hamas demands and leaving Hamas as the armed power in Gaza, ruling Gaza with and preparing themselves for another 7th of October and sending a message to everybody around the Middle East that, and beyond, that 7th of October was a successful attack and that's why everybody should follow. It's a very bad idea too. And taking over Gaza is also a bad idea because you end up being responsible for the population of Gaza. And there's going to be a lot of criticism around the globe. And beyond all, you cannot guarantee that you are going to get all the hostages alive, those who are still alive. And so the, none of the options is a good option. And the reasons not to take them are very sound and true. Nevertheless, the only way to move towards our targets, which is, as the goals were defined, releasing the hostages, removing Hamas from power, or defeating Hamas militarily and from the governmental point of view, and guaranteeing that Gaza is not going to be a launching pad for another attack like the 7th of October in the future, can be done if we really mean to take over Gaza. Unless Hamas believes that we are ready to do that, it is not going to show any flexibility, as we've seen until now. They have to be convinced that we are about to take over Gaza by force and remove them from power by force. And we have not managed to convince them that this is our intention until now, because it was not our intention. That's very simple. They read us very easily. And that's why they didn't act the way we wanted them to act. And only if they are convinced that we are going to take action and remove them by force, then they may consider moving towards a deal that deal that we are trying to accomplish for so long without success. And that's where we stand. So we have to take this decision. And yes, it comes with a price. It might eventually, if it's not good enough to convince them to go for a deal, we shall have to perform and to perform what we are threatening to do, and to take over Gaza. And what we have to do, and this, at the same time, is to prepare ourselves to what's going to happen once we take over Gaza. We shall have to have some sort of civil administration. We shall have to make an enormous effort together with the United States in order to form some group of countries and some Palestinians that will be ready to take it away from us and assume responsibility for Gaza in the future. It's not going to be done overnight, but we have to start working on that as we speak. It's also important in order to convince Hamas that we are serious. We are really preparing ourselves to this eventuality. And if we do that, there is a chance that it's going to work. There is also a chance that it's not going to work. We don't know the future. We have to make our utmost efforts in order to make the chances that it's going to work bigger than they are, and to mitigate all the bad impacts of such a move. We shall have to make sure that food is provided to the Palestinians living in Gaza. We shall have to make sure that we do it within a short period of time. People speak about 2 months of taking over all of Gaza. I believe it's more than the necessary, but it doesn't matter. Let it be 2 months. And the big question mark is how long this is going to take before we find somebody to take it from us, to replace us in Gaza. This is the big question if we move in this direction. And the hopeful developments that can happen is that Hamas will see that and say, okay, no, don't do that. We are ready to go to a deal. That would be wonderful, but we cannot build on that. We have to remember that in my mind, and it was there are many indications that this was the case, Hamas, when they launched the 7th of October, their safety net was that whatever happens, Israel is not going to remove us from power. Because this means that people have to assume responsibility for Gaza, and they are not going to do that. So we are now about to break their logic.
So as we're speaking, right, it seems very likely that, yes, we're about to go in full force. And it seems that the government is still sort of debating between two options, right, or the government and Tzahal. The IDF, they seem to want there to be more of like a siege, more of surrounding Gaza. And the government or Prime Minister Netanyahu seems to favor sort of conquering and occupying all of Gaza, right? Because there's about 25% of Gaza where the IDF hasn't even gone in. What do you think is the more effective option?
More effective option is the second one, because in the first one, it can be seen by Hamas as more of the same. Okay, we are under siege for a couple of months now, because the chariots of Gideon have changed the situation. It's not the raids and the going out, or the military doesn't raid an area and then goes out. We take an area and we stay. So that has been the case ever since the chariots of Gideon have been in action.
And that's since March, roughly, right?
Yes. So I think that what Netanyahu has in mind is more representing a change in the way we fight the war. It's going to be more impressive from the point of view of Hamas. Besides, there can be some combination of the two. when we, before we move into Gaza city, was the most important part of Gaza that was not taken over yet. We shall take action in order to remove the population away from there, move them towards the southern part of Gaza, where they can be provided with humanitarian aid and are not going to be threatened that they're going to pay a very heavy price while the war is being fought in the territory where they are. We have to remember the situation today is that people speak about 75%, 25%, but it's a misrepresentation of the situation. We control 75% of the territory, but most of it is unpopulated. The Hamas controls 25% of the territory, which is densely populated, and all the population of Gaza is in there. Almost all of the population of Gaza is in areas controlled by Hamas, which allows Hamas to keep its grip over the population. And this is the source of power that it has, because he also controls the much of the humanitarian aid that's coming in and uses it in order to finance its activities and recruit new people. That's where we stand. So it's not about percentage of the area. It's about who controls the population of Gaza.
Cooper, we had the pleasure of working together for many years at the Strategic Affairs Ministry, and you were also one of the first founding fellows at the Miskab Institute. But before your career in government, you had a long and decorated career in the IDF. And in 2005, you were head of research and analysis in IDF intelligence, in military intelligence. During the period of the disengagement from Gaza, the expulsion of the Jewish communities and Jewish residents from Gaza, handing the decision to hand Gaza over to the Palestinian Authority, which was later taken over by Hamas. Let me ask, how did you feel about the disengagement at the time? Obviously, you were in uniform, so your ability to speak out was impacted by that. But how did you feel about the disengagement at the time? Have your views changed? And what was the impact of the 2005 engagement on the October 2023 terror attack?
Well, you know, the decision to make, to have the disengagement surprised me a lot. And I remember the day when I was told about it, and I went to the chief of staff to tell him about the meeting that I was representing the military in, where the secret was shared with us. And I totally misunderstood the logic behind it. I thought that this was a kind of a threat to make Abu Mazen take certain steps towards Israel, and or actually the Palestinians, I think it was still Arafat. This was the logic that I attributed to this strange move by Sharon. During the time that we were preparing ourselves to the implementation of the disengagement, there was a very important meeting of the cabinet, which the major issue of discussion was the Philadelphia corridor. Should we leave the Philadelphia corridor or not? And I'm saying it because disengagement by itself is a strange move, but leaving Philadelphia was even stranger, because for me it was clear that this was going to be used by the Palestinians in order to bring in enormous amounts of weapons, and God knows what's going to happen next. We had enough problems with the Palestinian terrorism in Gaza before the disengagement. Imagine what would have happened if we opened Philadelphia. And there was a debate with Sharon at the time. And I was very clear that in my mind, leaving Philadelphia is going to be to have terrible repercussions. And Sharon said, no, I want to leave Philadelphia, because once we leave Philadelphia, nobody can claim that we are occupiers of Gaza. Let them have an open way out and in through Egypt. Nobody is going to tell us that we are the occupiers of Gaza. And I said to him, I remember this very well, I said to him, Mr. Prime Minister, it doesn't matter what you are going to do with Philadelphia. You are going to be seen as the occupier of Gaza, because nobody is going to let you off this hook, and regardless of what you are going to do. And we are going to pay the price of leaving Philadelphia, because all these weapons are going to come in huge amounts. And he said, no. I believe that if I leave Philadelphia, they are not going to refer to us as the occupiers of Gaza. Of course, he was terribly wrong, and that we paid the heavy price. And if you ask me what happened because of the, what is the impact of the disengagements and what we've seen on October 7th, is the fact that they were able to bring in all those weapons. Look, we are fighting for 22 months. They still don't feel a shortage of weapons. They still carry out terror attacks. They have enough weapons. They have enough shelters, you know, to keep their terrorists in, safe. And that's what we are experiencing because of this disengagement. I mean, it's very difficult to say what if, what would have been the situation if we have not done the disengagement. God knows. And but the disengagement enabled them through the open Philadelphia corridor to get in whatever they wanted. That's why we suffered for almost 20 years now because of this decision. And beyond, it reflected the success of the terrorism. It was translated as if the terrorists won the war. And no wonder that Hamas took over Gaza later on, because the feeling was that Hamas terrorism was the fact that brought us to this decision, and not the wise political moves of Abu Mazen. Clearly, this was a prize to terror. It was seen as a prize for terror. In this respect, too, the impact was difficult for us. I mean, this battle between the more moderate Palestinians and the more radical Palestinians, the disengagement emboldened the radical ones considerably. I mean, they were under they were pretty strong beforehand as well, but they became even stronger afterwards. So from all these aspects, the disengagement was problematic. And, but then again, this was already a fait accompli. And we had to develop a policy towards Gaza that was taking into account the fact that not only we had a disengagement, but also Hamas took over in 2007. And these were facts on the ground. We could have wiped them down because of the disengagement, but this is not going to help us. And the policy we have developed for many years made sense. We said, okay, this is a fact on the ground. We are not going to take over Gaza again. You know, I'll tell you a story. When the first time that Hamas launched in rockets towards Israel after the disengagement, this was 2005, Fatah was still in power in Gaza. The question was, what are we going to do in retaliation to the launching of 50 rockets towards Israel in November 2005? And I remember me saying to the chief of staff at the time, Chalutz, General Chalutz, I said, we have to take over the northern part of Gaza from where they launched the rockets, and show them that, as we said, if one rocket is going to be launched towards Israel, we should respond very dramatically. And Chalutz told me, and I think he reflected the feeling of the government, we didn't leave Gaza in order to re-enter Gaza. So we didn't come good on our threat to re-enter Gaza. And I'm saying it because people say, let's leave Gaza and leave Hamas in power. And well, if they launch one rocket, we should do this and that. This is not working. It's we know from history it doesn't work. And because of that, we developed a policy that said, okay, we cannot change the situation on the ground. There's no point in us entering Gaza and taking over Gaza again. We'll make a policy that will keep Hamas deterred and weak vis-a-vis Israel, but strong and capable to govern vis-a-vis the other factions in the Gaza Strip. And yes, from time to time, there are going to be some clashes, some really intense confrontation between us and them, but we should be able to deter them and charge a heavy price from them, and have another long period of time without clashes.
So I think that that policy, that idea, right, is what has been come to be known in Israel as the konseptzia, as the sort of misconception of the reality in Gaza, right? What do you think that Israel has learned from the disengagement and sort of the post-disengagement experience that it's now taking forward?
Before you add to that question, we recently saw a video of a number of former IDF chief of staffs and heads of Shabak and other senior military and security officials from the past.
Including General Khalutz, who you mentioned.
Right, a lot of them from your time. And to me, it seems like they're repeating the same slogans that you just described as having failed us. So the question is, you know, what's changed? And do you think that among the military and security leadership is a change in thinking after October 7th as well?
Well, I think there is a change. And without criticizing my ex-commanders, I would say that they are stuck in this old thinking because it's not working. It didn't work. I wrote a paper in June 2023 called "This Armament of Gaza." And before the war, you know, a couple of months before the war, I issued a paper saying, "Look, this policy is not working anymore. We believe that Hamas is deterred. Hamas is not deterred. Our policy that allows them to arm themselves to the teeth, without doing anything about it, is going to cost us a lot, and it's better to disarm them even by force, without the international legitimacy and without domestic legitimacy, and knowing that we are going to pay a heavy price. It's still better because the alternative is that they are going to be those who are going to have the initiative, and the price we are going to pay is going to be much, much, much higher." And I think by now everybody realizes that I was right at the time. At the time when I presented that to all kinds of people, they said to me, "Cooper, what's wrong with you? Don't you know Hamas is deterred? Don't you know that Hamas is weak?" I said, "No, Hamas is not weak and it's not deterred." There are not many people who wanted to listen to me. But now I think everybody understands this is the case. I think. Turns out it's not the case. Some people want to go back to where we are. Look, Hamas has not changed. Hamas, raison d'etre, is to destroy Israel and to wipe it off the map. Hamas' raison d'etre is to have Palestine from the river to the sea without any Jews. This is the Hamas reason to keep ruling Gaza. It's not because they like providing water and sewage to the people of Zaytun. They have another thing in mind. And if we are not going to do anything about it, it's going to take them some time, but they are going to be back on our doorsteps. So we have to do something. We have to learn the lessons. And the lesson is that you are not going to allow the deployment of terror armies next to your border. And we are doing it in Gaza, and I hope we are going to do it in Gaza. The most important thing is to not let Hamas stay in power in Gaza, whatever happens. And we are doing it in Lebanon. We are not going to allow Hezbollah to deploy in the south and to rearm itself. And we are doing it in Syria, where we are determined not to allow armed jihadists to deploy next to our border. And we are doing it even in Judea and Samaria, where we take steps that we didn't take in the past in order to clean the refugee camps near to our border.
Now that you mentioned Judea and Samaria, I want to take you to that arena. And you served also as the chief intelligence officer of Central Command, which is in charge of Judea and Samaria of the West Bank. I think there are very few people who understand the Palestinians and the Palestinian discourse and narrative better than you. I'll just tell one quick story. We were studying, when we were at the Strategic Affairs Ministry, we were studying the issue of Palestinian incitement. So we went to go talk to Palestinian terrorists who were incarcerated in an Israeli security prison. And we're sitting there. They brought out hummus for us. We're sitting, we're eating hummus with them. And one of them says, "I was part of this terror group that in Shechem, in Nablus, would come out and shoot." And you said, "Oh yeah, I was in this post, and you would come out and shoot at us every night. All of Shechem would come out and shoot at us. And he said, "Oh no, it wasn't all of Shechem. We were only five or six people." And we're sitting there laughing with them and eating with them hummus. But given your experience with the Palestinian Authority, what do you think should be Israel's future goals with regards to Judea and Samaria, the West Bank? Abu Mazen at some point is going to leave the international stage. What should be Israel's vision or Israel's plan for the future of the West Bank?
Well, the future of the West Bank is a very bleak at this point, because, as you say, everybody realizes Abu Mazen is the glue that keeps everything together, is going to leave us sometime soon. He's 89 years old. And this is not going to last forever. And everybody is preparing themselves for the day after. And we would like to see the Palestinians governing themselves in an authority that is able to fight against terror and to care for their people. That's what we want to see happening. But the prospects of that taking place are not very high because everybody is there preparing to hold the throat of his friend or opponent. And so many local landlords are going to be saying something about how the future is going to look like. It's very difficult to avoid the chaos. And I'm quite concerned about what's going to happen there. I'm afraid that the most probable scenario is chaos, and which is something that we are determined not to allow happening, which would require our intervention in order to prevent it. That's not something we would like to see, but we might be forced to do in spite of the fact that we don't like to see. Just like in Gaza, we don't want to, we didn't want to enter Gaza, but we are forced to. And that's, I'm afraid, what's going to happen in Judea and Samaria as well. But if you ask me what we want to see, we want, as I said, to see a Palestinian self-rule that can take care of the betterment of the lives of the Palestinians in this area, that would live in peaceful relationships with Israel. That's what we would like to see. And we are trying to convince the world that something has to be done in order to make it happen. First and foremost, to change the education system and stop the incitement. And because what's happening right now is that the incitement helps the Palestinians to keep inculcating in their minds the narrative of the Palestinians. It's very problematic from our point of view. That calls for and continuous struggle against Israel. There's at least one big difference between the struggle that is recommended by the PA and the struggle that is recommended by Hamas. Hamas favors an armed struggle with terrorism and killing babies and these kind of things. The Palestinian Authority thinks that though this is a legitimate activity, it's not recommended at this point of time, and we should go for the popular struggle that is more using violence without the use of firearms and explosives. That's what they have in mind. They're still in favor of a struggle, but in more moderate ways.
So if we go back to what you said about the possibility of chaos in the aftermath of Mahmoud Abbas, I remember years ago, Zev Elkin took this up as like his cause. I'm trying to remember if he was a cabinet minister, he was the head of the Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee, but he kept warning that Israel needs to plan for this. Do you think that Israel has a plan? What happens if there's a breakdown of the Palestinian Authority after Abbas dies?
I think some attention was given to this issue before the war. And this was on the agenda. I remember me speaking about and presenting the five options that I had in mind about what's going to happen in Gaza, in the PA after Abu Mazen, in the Knesset, some discussion in the Knesset. Once the war began, the thinking about what's going to happen in the PA took a backstage, and much less attention has been given to that. I think the government should pay more attention to this issue, because this is going to happen one day. It's always going to happen by surprise. All of a sudden, Abu Mazen is going to have some disease, and I don't know what's going to happen. He would have to leave the post he's filling now, and there's going to be a big void that would have to be filled, and nobody would know what's going to happen. And this is going to be caught again unprepared. So I think since this is an eventuality that can be thought of, we should rather think about what to do. I mean, there is this new idea that Barkat is trying to promote, of the Moti Kedar idea of the Emirates. I wish them luck, but I don't think it's more like it's going to happen by itself, because during the chaos, everybody's going to be busy with its own fiefdom. and Rajub can be strong in Hebron, and Tirawi can be strong in Nablus, and Hussein Sheikh can be strong in Ramallah, and it's going to fall apart, and there are all the families and the clans that are strong in all kinds of places. It's they don't have a culture of state, of even an autonomy that can be functioning. They're still made of a lot of small elements that comprise together something that's called the Palestinian people. There is people who don't vote on the Palestinian side, but it's not strong enough in order to convince everybody to give up their interests in favor of something that's bigger than their own interests. And as long as there is this glue, Abu Mazen or Arafat, it was possible to keep them all together. But once this glue is going to fade away, I'm not sure that this is still going to be the case.
The war in Gaza had a very significant impact on global public opinion, including in the United States, particularly among youth, but among people from both parties, from all political affiliations. And we've been seeing, on the one hand, criticism, which is obviously legitimate. On the other hand, campaigns of delegitimization, demonization. You led, both within the government of Israel and outside the government of Israel, the campaign, the fight against delegitimization, BDS. What do you think Israel can do, given the realities that you described in Gaza? What can Israel do in order to counter these anti-Israel campaigns and to strengthen, improve its international standing in the global arena?
Well, a lot. Israel can do a lot. And I recommend watching the webinar we held in the Jerusalem Institute for Strategy and Security a couple of days ago with Professor Alan Dershowitz and Michal Kotler-Runj, that is the envoy, the Israeli envoy for combating the anti-Semitism, and with Adam Milstein, who founded the Israeli-American Council. That referred to this issue, and what Dershowitz was saying there was really worrying, and because he pointed the fact that anti-Israeli sentiments are not only confined to the radical left, but you can see them in other places in the United States, and especially among young people. And it's when you look at the future, it's going to be a major problem, and that's why Israel should take severe steps in order to be ready to prepare to fight this war as well. Now, first and foremost, I think we need intelligence. You can't fight a war without intelligence, and we don't spend a penny for intelligence on this issue.
But maybe just clarify that. I don't think you mean that the Mossad is going to start gathering intelligence on youth movements in America. So can you just clarify what you mean by intelligence?
I don't think the Mossad necessarily, but I think Israel should invest money and resources in collecting information about what's actually happening to better understand the phenomena and understand who's standing behind it. I'll tell you something, for example, talking about intelligence. This starvation campaign was not happening just out of the blue. All of the one day there was a picture and there was a campaign. No. This was a well-planned campaign by Hamas and its supporters in the media. And we should have known about it in advance and prepare our counter-offensive in advance. We could have done that. It was a very well-orchestrated campaign. We should have known about it in advance and prepare ourselves. We did not, and we paid a heavy price for not being prepared from the intelligence point of view. We didn't know about something that was about to happen. That's what I mean. And you can't find any. I'm coming from the intelligence, okay? So I tell you that you can't fight a war successfully without the proper preparation of the intelligence, of the battlefield from the intelligence point of view. And who are those Students for Justice in Palestine? Who is the other groups that are involved in that? And who finances them? And what is the role of Qatar in that? And there's a big role of Qatar in that. And what is the role of Iran? What is the role of other parties that are involved? What is Hamas' role? What is the Palestinian Authority role? The BDS organization is an organization. You should know much Well, how it functions, where does it get this money from? Many people think that all kinds of billionaires are behind that. So what are their role? Some of them are Jewish, right? And there are many Jews that are involved in this effort as well. So it's a major issue that we should learn more deeply about. And then again, we don't have the equivalent of a chief of staff working for us. There's no chief of staff. So there's nobody in the government that, and when the government convenes a meeting on the war, there's nobody sitting there and saying, look, this effort that you were talking about encircling Gaza and taking over the rest of the 25% is going to cost us a lot in the field of public opinion. These are the things we should take into account when we do that. I'm not saying not to do that. I'm just saying, well, once you do it, you should also do this and this and that, in order to be effective in the battlefield of the public opinion. Nobody sits there. Nobody has this responsibility. So nobody says the obvious. These are not missile engineering, but it's very simple. But these are certain issues and things that you need to do. And if there's nobody who says because there's nobody responsible for that, and unbelievably, we are fighting this war for 22 months now without somebody who's in charge of the public sphere. That's there was plenty of time to nominate somebody to do that. Everybody has a certain part of this elephant, but nobody is responsible for the entire elephant. And it's an elephant. It's the elephant in the room. We are paying, and we are going to pay even more for not doing something about it. Again, I recommend going back to this webinar, because many practical issues were put on the table in this. Vunch is, Michal Kotler Vunch is doing all kinds of stuff, and she has all kinds of ideas, but I don't know that these are really having an impact on the battlefield. One more thing about the media. We should not trust the media. The media is, most of the media is against us. Right from the beginning, regardless of what we're doing, they're against us. And when you see the way they treated the pictures of those two children that were suffering from other diseases and presenting them as suffering from starvation, tells you a fortune about what to expect from the media. There's no ethics. The media has no ethics. And you have to take this into account. You don't expect the media to be ethical, because they don't. They're not. New York Times has no ethics when it comes to Israel. They have no ethics.
Unfortunately, yeah, that is the case. They just republish Hamas propaganda as if it's true. Well, Yossi Cooper-Wesser, thank you so much for being with us. Your insights are always interesting and enlightening. And so we hope to have you back sometime.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and like the Mishkav Institute across all social media and podcast platforms. You can follow us at www.mishkavins.org and send your questions, comments, suggestions to MideasterHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. That's MideasterHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com, and we'll see you next week.